It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
In 1938, the Knights belonged to Harlem. The place to be was Club Sugar Ray's. The man to know was Quick.
Now, when you see Quick, I suggest you guys make plans to go elsewhere.
You, I ain't afraid of going up against Smalls or Calhoun.
That's because you're young.
Come on!
Full of vigor.
I work for Mr. Calhoun.
What kind of work do you do?
Whatever's required.
What would a woman that fine want in a big, fat, nasty, greasy, 12 sandwich eating? What does she want with it?
Oh, man, she likes fat guys.
Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Red Fox, Danny Aiello.
It's nice to meet you.
Michael Lerner, Della Reese, Jasmine Guy.
I'd like to go upstairs.
Arsenio Hall.
Oh, Quick as mine.
Gotta stop overreacting.
Overreacted?
Harlem Nights.
I thought I was the only person who slept with his guns under the pillow. Look at her little gun. Oh.
Coming Friday, November 17th at theaters everywhere.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am joined, as always, by my partner and friend, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to record this with you again. And we are joined, it's been a long time. It just keeps happening this way, but we have Matt and Christy Huntsworth with us, who I don't remember the last time you guys were on, but welcome back.
Why, thank you.
Hola, ¿cómo está? Oh, wait, someone started me in Spanish like they did the movie the other night when we watched it. I think to answer your question, I don't remember the timeline. Like, I don't remember how long ago it was, but I believe the last movie we've discussed with you was Muppet's Christmas Carol.
Yes.
Oh, we have to have talked since then.
Oh, we've talked, but I don't think we've been on this show together since then.
That's possible. And that's a very long time ago.
Yes.
So, welcome back.
Oh, wait, I take that back. It might have been Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes.
I forgot about that one. Yes. Yes.
Yes. And you were on once or twice in between, too, Matt.
Correct.
We did Silverado and the right Stuff.
Yep. That's correct. Okay.
So today I threw out to say, what movie do you guys want to watch? And Matt indicated that Christy watches Harlem Nights about once a month.
for
the last 40 years.
Yeah,
kind of.
So
it is one of those ones that stop right on the as soon as I see it on the TV, no change in the channel.
Well, I had the Mandela effect with this movie because I could have sworn I saw it, and I had to really think back because I just watched it yesterday now. That is the first time I ever watched it from beginning to end. What I had experienced back in 1989 when this came out was somebody I know, I can't tell you who, had bought one of the bootleg VHS copies in Manhattan. And you know those copies, somebody in the movie theater with the camera, and the sound quality is awful. And then it's been stepped on about 30 or 40 times. So it's, the video is terrible. somebody had a copy like that that they lent me and said, oh, you got to watch this movie. And I watched about the first 10 or 15 minutes, and the quality of the tape was so bad that I didn't watch it anymore. And for whatever reason, for the last 40 years or so, or 36 years, I guess, I've been thinking, oh, yeah, I saw this movie, which I had not. So yesterday was really the first time I ever watched it. I am the anti-Christie.
Wow. Yeah.
Don't worry. I watched it enough for everybody in on this call.
Yes.
How about you, Sean?
I saw this in 89. I saw it in the theater. It was funny when you suggested this one as a film that we were going to do. I was excited because of the fact that I don't remember it. I mean, I remember the cast and that piece, but the last time I saw it was in 89. I don't know why I haven't seen it since then. I remember liking it. But much like you, this was like seeing a brand new movie, and I have a lot of thoughts about it. So this will be a fun discussion.
So I guess we could get separately since you said Christie watches it so frequently. Yeah. Matt, what's your experience with this one? Besides looking in the room and seeing the light. Yeah,
there is that. But for my first viewing, I was working in a movie theater. We talk about this a lot on the shows we do over on our website. All of us know each other from the movie theater days, and we watched everything. It didn't matter what it was. Absolutely everything. And this is, I saw it. It's probably the night before it was released, because that's when we would have to put these. This is when you had to put physical media together. You weren't just downloading it to a digital projector. So we put it together, make sure it was all in the right order and not any kind of off frame cuts or anything. And this is, I think, usually we'd run them all at once and dip in and out of the houses seeing it. And then we'd save one for last, or to watch all the way through. This is one of our save one for last ones. So I'm watching it middle of the night when it first came out. And when, let's see, I'd probably say when home video, not necessarily, I don't think I owned it on home video, like a physical thing, but like cable, and it finally hit cable, I'd watch it a few times during that. And now that it's available on streaming, I don't actively seek it out, but it tends to, as you'll learn here in just a minute, be on my TV quite often. So I will kind of stop and watch it to a point, which we'll talk about. I have a perfect comparison movie to this of how I view this, but we'll get to that. But yeah, that's right. It's been in and out of my life for 40 years now.
So Christie, how did you fall in love with this movie?
Like most movies in the 80s, I didn't really go to the movies a lot, but I had a pirated HBO that my father put a tin can on the side of our house, and it used to bounce signal off a mountain next to us. So somehow we ended up with HBO. That is pretty much where I saw most R-rated movies, including this one. I believe it was right after an episode of Not Necessarily the News. I have a very big fondness for Richard Pryor. And I loved everything. I watched See No Evil, Hear No Evil. What was it? All of his Gene Wilder movies that he did.
Mm-hmm. Silver Streak.
Silver Streak.
Stir Crazy.
I mean, all of those, I watched them on HBO, and I'm like, well, at the time, Eddie Murphy, I had been a huge SNL fan. So it was time to see two of my favorites and Red Fox, because I loved Sanford and Son and Arsenio Hall. So, I mean, there were so many people in this movie that I had to see that every time it was on. Now, at the time, it was not at the level of Porky's, where I watched Porky's a lot, much to the chagrin of my parents who never knew. But now, as I got older, I just, I have just a little soft spot for it. And there was one day that we actually have it on DVD that we found in the $5 bin at Walmart. So if it ever stops streaming, I have it.
Oh, good.
And that's where I know it's going off the beaten path a little bit, but that's where I defend physical media, because you never know when something's not going to be available on a certain streaming service. And, if it's something that you love, you want to have access to it. My sister recently had her grandchildren over, and they lost cable for the day. And because of the cable and the streaming and all of that, they no longer had all the physical media. So they had these toddlers that they were babysitting, and all of a sudden they had nothing to put on for.
No.
So she said, you know, it was, it became a little bit of a chore to try and keep them entertained and yet keep her house, you know, in somewhat of an order. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I still have a ton of DVDs and, you know, digital copies of things that I'm not getting rid of because, you know, if my cable goes down or if my internet goes down, I want to be able to still entertain myself. And I happen to be addicted to my television set. Mm. So I don't, you know, I definitely am an advocate of keeping physical copies of things that you love. Now, watching this effectively for the first time, the only scene I remembered as I was watching it that I could say, okay, yeah, I remember that from 36 years ago, was the scene when Eddie Murphy and Della Reese fight.
That is the best scene.
It is. Yeah. One of the two best scenes.
That was it. So the rest of the movie was all really brand new to me. And I had like mixed feelings about it, to be totally honest. You know, I saw in reading up a little bit about it that this was, you know, something where Eddie Murphy always wanted to direct a movie. This is the only movie he ever directed. There were moments where I thought it was very good and I laughed out loud. And there were moments when I thought it was a little self-indulgent. So I did go back and forth a little bit on that. But overall, I thought it was entertaining to, you know, just give it the general feel. I thought it was, for the only directing effort he ever had, I thought it was fairly well done. Eddie Murphy is the person who I use as an example when I talk about sometimes if you read a script, it doesn't seem all that funny until you have the actor put his take on it. Eddie Murphy is one of these people who the way he says his lines is usually more funny than the line that is itself. And I saw examples of that in this movie, where if I was reading it on a paper, I probably wouldn't even smirk. And yet, watching it here, I actually laughed at times. So, again, mixed feelings, but overall entertaining.
One of the things I will say, I didn't realize he wrote this, as well as being the director. I really like the fact that he made the choice to make Richard Pryor the star. I know it's a weird thing to say because Eddie Murphy's got such a prominent role in this one, but Richard Pryor really is, in my mind, he was the star of this one. And Eddie was more of the sidekick. It's, if I'm linking it to anything else, I never thought I would link this film to that, but to the Sting. Where you've got Redford and Newman, where Redford's really the lead, and where Newman's really the lead and Redford is the sidekick. I feel like their relationship worked that way. And the endearing nature of Richard Pryor in this is really pivotal to this film, I thought. So I think that's an area where I think he gave, and especially with the fact that this has got such talent in it, he did a good job of spotlighting a lot of comedic talent that at the time of this film, some of them had not been seen for a while in, mm-hmm. in some form of a prominent role. And he did a really good job of showing that there's a lot of the people that are involved in this that he clearly loves because he wrote a film that really embraces that camaraderie between all of them. And I was reading something actually on IMDb about how they're funnier and more camaraderie moments, for lack of a better way of putting it, actually occurred off the camera more than anything else, just because of the fact that they had such a good time working together on this one. That was apparent in the film, though, because the chemistry between them did not feel fake. And that's something you either are able to pull off in a film or you're not. And these felt like it was a family type atmosphere for this, this crime empire that was being created there. But it fit. And I actually, they're all bad guys, really, in kind of the way you're looking at it. But there were definitely bad guys I was rooting for in this one. And I'm still left with that feeling of these are very endearing people.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see them survive. I wanted to see them win. And I loved that aspect of it.
And Richard Pryor in this, and I'm not going to say this is the only film he does this in, but he acts more in this than he is as a, using it as a comedy piece. He's performing and just kind of letting everyone around him be the funny people, which really makes me enjoy his performance in this even more so.
Definitely. And I think the thing that it's up there with Johnny Dangerously for me.
Okay.
Because
good connection.
Yeah. I really did love that genre of movie where it was like in the gangster times of the 20s and just the ironic and weird jokes that would happen because of it. I think that's why this movie and Johnny Dangerously are two of my like little soft spots from the 80s.
It's a pretty impressive ensemble cast that haven't been all together before. You don't get the sense that this is the first thing they've done for me. It's like, this these people we see Quick as a child open the movie and then he's a full grown adult. So you already know that they've had a lifetime together, but you're they never have to convince you of that. It's from the get go. You know that they've all been together their whole lives. And it's pretty impressive considering they've not worked together before.
And I never knew Della Reese was funny.
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm.
She used to appear on Sanford and Son every once in a while.
And I remember that. I saw it later and remembered it, but you know, my brain got stuck on, you know, Touched by an Angel, and I was like, oh, she's so serious. Oh, she's not.
Now, just because you mentioned Johnny Dangerously, another movie that comes to mind, and I haven't seen it in probably close to 40 years, so I don't know if the quality is there or not, but another one along those lines is City Heat with Burt Reynolds and Clint Eastwood. Oh, it's another one that takes place, I believe, in the 1920s and the same kind of thing, and it's definitely a lighthearted action movie. So that one might fit in with these also.
Probably. I don't recall seeing that one.
I remember seeing it, but man, it's been a long time.
The setting of this film benefits from that. I feel like watching it now, it doesn't feel like a dated movie. And I feel like the setting and the atmosphere of it, that was something that really stood out for me as far as it, I think it works, you know, as far as like, I would recommend somebody watching this now who didn't see it in the 80s. And I don't feel like you overly are going to feel this is a dated movie. And I think that's common with movies that are more set in a period. I think they benefit from that piece. And this film certainly did, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yep.
Now, you mentioned Richard Pryor's performance in this, and I find Richard Pryor to be a very interesting film actor in general, in most of the movies, you know, the ones you mentioned earlier and this. Because he had a strong reputation for being, you know, very, very edgy, very, you know, in your face. And when he's been in movies, you know, if you don't count his live stand-up comedy movies, I always find him to be a much softer and gentler person than he's presented as, you know, from his stand-up routine. He does have, you know, a fatherly feeling towards Eddie Murphy in this movie, and the chemistry does feel real, and he does seem like somebody who you'd want to sit down and have a beer with, and you'd enjoy his company. And I find that that's like every movie he's in. So he doesn't give you that edgy feeling as an actor that he was supposed to as a person. And I think that works to his benefit in these movies.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I'm looking at his filmography now to kind of remind me. And yeah, a lot of that, I just lost what I was looking at. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, he was very, what's the word, boisterous on stage, but he does have more of, especially when you're kind of, when he's like doing a one-on-one with somebody, like I'm thinking like some really weird examples, like the toy, like when he's trying to get the kid, you know, talk to the kid, he's very soft spoken, and like you're listening to what he's saying because he's kind of got that tone that what he's saying is something you need to listen to without being forced to listen to it or scared to have them. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say there, but yeah. Chrissy's looking at me like, what are you trying
to say? No, I think a lot of his stand-up is there's a different kind of energy behind it.
Yeah, there you go. That's
like watching, I mean, of the comedians of the time, like watching Robin Williams. Robin Williams on stage in his stand-up, yep. But compared to, you know, any of his acting stuff, that it's a very different energy.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely a different energy and a different presentation. But just with Richard Pryor, when he had his stand-up, you know, it was almost kind of like that, you know, you don't mess with me kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, where he felt like almost like a tough guy. And in all these movies, he seems very, very approachable and very, you know, like somebody who you'd like. Not so tough.
Yes, there you go.
So I do find, and I think, I wonder if his reputation even might have hurt him overall as far as his career goes, because I think people were afraid to give him parts where he could stretch his acting ability because of his reputation. And I think he probably would have been a bigger acting star if people hadn't been quite so reticent to use him.
Well, I think he and, like I said, Robin Williams, definitely. If you went off of Robin Williams' stand-up, you would never have seen him in Good Will Hunting. You would never have seen him in Dead Poets Society. You would not imagine that subdued energy. That's even like, for some reason, it popped into my brain about John Belushi in The Continental Divide. Have you ever seen that movie?
Yes.
Yes. And I remember when they were actually making that movie, I was working as a bank teller while I was in school. And there was one of the women who worked at the bank who had been, you know, she's probably in her early 20s at the time, but, you know, she seemed older. And her husband had just gone on a vacation. And apparently they went to wherever they were filming Continental Divide.
Oh, wow.
And she had said that they, like, it was a very, very closed set and they were, you know, They were saying, you know, don't tell anybody about this because this is going to be John Belushi's breakout role as a serious actor. And, you know, it's a shame where his life went, unfortunately, because I think he had the potential of being a much better. I think he had the potential of doing basically the same thing cinematically that Robin Williams did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, definitely. I still remember that movie just so vividly that I remember loving it when I was a kid.
You know, it's funny, we were talking about the subtle nature of Richard Pryor in this, and I think it worked really well in the time passage, because we had that 20-year time passage where you had the younger version of Eddie Murphy's character, Quick, and then you had the 20-year passage for the older version of him. They kept referring then in that 20-year passage to Richard Pryor's character, Sugar Ray, as the old man. Kind of implying that he was more at the tail end of his career. Some of that was, you know, intimidation from, you know, the villains of the story, so to speak. But he played that well, like he was at a different stage in his life where he was taking care of people and much more concerned with, you know, setting everyone up to be okay and being willing to kind of step back from the craziness. The thing I loved about all that is when things do start going haywire in this, he ends up being a big player in some things that you don't see coming. There's layers to the actual sting of this one really liked. I liked that it wasn't just, because it could have gone very basic with it. I liked that it was layered. I liked that they remained one step ahead of everyone who was trying to come after them because of the fact that they accounted for the different things that could happen. And Richard Pryor's character played that. Sugar Ray played that so well. I just really liked that. And I did like the sense that he felt a little bit older in the later portion of the film. He did a very good job as an actor of making me feel like there was some sense of time passage for him. Subtle, but
right. But I also thought they let the aging be realistic. It was 20 years. Now, you know, when I was 20, and if you tell me, oh, what are you going to look like in 20 years? I would think, you know, I'm going to look like, you know, the old man New Year's with the long beard and whatever. But, you know, as you get significantly beyond 20 years, you know, you start realizing 20 years is not that enormous of a period of time.
Right.
And you don't age, you know, some people age a lot in that time, but some people, you know, the aging is more subtle. And I do think the way they presented him kind of fit that. He did seem older, but he didn't seem like an old man.
Right.
And I thought that was key to the way he was presented.
Like, this was his, it wasn't necessarily set up to be his final, like, act in this underground border, well, not even borderline, but this type of criminal world, but it ended up, I think that was the sense we were supposed to get. Like, this was his, now that this is done, this is his last thing. And it's, it was like all of his life's experiences in this world came out to this, and he came out on top. And you can easily think he's living happy ever after.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I got a big kick as I watched this out of Red Fox in it.
Yeah, and
it wasn't like, there were points where I thought, oh, you could use him more. You know, you should play on him a little bit more. But I think the interplay between him and Della Reese, the back and forth, I just loved it. The two of them had me cracking up throughout this. And I just happened to have a soft spot for Red Fox. And again, much like Christy from Sanford and Son, you know, that show, when I see it now, I still get such a big kick out of it. And, you know, I do the Elizabeth, I'm coming to my wife all the time. So
yeah, the you hit the nail on the head, the interaction with him and Della Reese's character. I mean, that is the two characters that I watched that you feel like, for me at least, they have been talking like this to each other since the dawn of time. Like, this is how it's always been. And neither of them just they don't even hear it at this point. They just played that interaction so well.
And I remember on Sanford and Son, one of Fred Sanford's friends, I couldn't tell you which one it was. It wasn't Grady, but one of his friends, and they had an episode where they needed to get somebody to like be an entertainer or something like that. And he kept saying, my niece is Della Reese. And then they brought her on. She played herself, and she came in to perform. And she was the niece of one of his cronies on that show.
Oh, wow.
So they, but the two of them obviously had, you know, somewhat of a relationship off screen as friends or whatever from her appearing on that show. So, you know, I guess you could see the chemistry that they had based on that friendship.
Right, right.
I was glad that they, so with Red Fox, it's very easy to look at his comedy and similar to Richard Pryor's, where you could, especially if you're a fan of his, which Eddie Murphy clearly was, and go really over the top with them.
Oh, yeah.
These characters all made sense in this world. Yep. Like, and that was something that I think is, there's a danger when you're working with people who are your heroes to like lean heavily into their strengths. And I felt like in this one, everyone fit. Like, there wasn't somebody that I'm like, oh, geez, I wish they didn't go so crazy with that. It like took me out of the environment. I understood the rules of this world and really was taken into it, which I think is something that is hard to do when you've got these big personalities in this. There's a lot of big personalities in this. And it was,
everyone kind of really steps well out of their way. Mm-hmm. Like, they all give each other the space, which is really nice.
Yeah, and I think that was another key where Murphy's direction in the movie did a good job, because it didn't, it wasn't confusing, and it could have easily have been with all of these big characters or, you know, big personalities going around. This movie was not highly thought of.
No, which surprised
Siskel me. Siskel and Ebert made it one of the 10 worst movies of 1989. It gets 27% on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm not exactly sure. You know, I do recall, and we talked about this just the other day, where we were saying about how Siskel and Ebert, when they rated their bad movies of the year, they didn't just find the worst movies. They would find the movies that they thought were the most disappointing.
Oh, okay.
And so there is a little bit of a difference, but now I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page. Both Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert panned the film. It was featured on their Worst of 1989 review show, with Siskel stating that it was racist, sexist, and badly directed, and Ebert agreeing with him, also adding that they thought Murphy was directing a film to call himself a director. Again, I really enjoyed Siskel and Ebert back in the day, but I have to disagree with them on this. I thought you know, and to go into the dangerous territory of racism for a movie that had a very black cast overall. I didn't feel that it was uninviting at all. I didn't feel that it was excluding me as a non-black person. I didn't think it was one of these ones, well, you can't understand it because you're not black. I didn't think there was any of that. I thought it was funny for its own benefit, and these characters all seemed, you know, pretty cool to me.
Yeah, and then if I'm not sure, the racist part kind of, it surprises me a little bit, but doesn't, maybe it's because so much time has passed and it's not as, like seeing it the other night, you know, it's almost a 40-year-old movie, but the only thing I could think of when I was watching it that might have come up with that was some of the language they used, but it was just part of the period vernacular, for better or for worse, well, for worse, and it wasn't, racism wasn't part of the story
but
in
any
regard.
But it was supposed to make you hate them even more.
Really, like you're it was supposed really the bad hate. Guys that...
You're supposed to hate Danny Aiello,
right.
And I hated Danny Aiello at the end, like, throughout this.
You're also supposed to hate Michael Lerner, and you do.
Yeah.
Michael Lerner was, and it was great. That was a fun character to hate through this movie. It's just because he was just smart enough to like, this could happen. I mean, having seen the movie 40 times this year alone, I know it's not going to. But the first time, you're like, oh man, he actually is on to something. Crap, I don't like this. I don't like the bad guy being that smart.
Yeah,
it was strategically being used by them. By the bad guys at certain points in time to intimidate.
And
so, I mean, it was definitely something. It wasn't just thrown in and overused. It was really done for a very specific purpose. And I thought like it made sense what he was trying to do with it.
Yeah.
And you see, I didn't think of this as Eddie Murphy using black actors and actresses because they're black.
No,
I thought he used them because they were people who he idolized growing up.
Great. Mm-hmm.
And I don't see anything wrong with that. I really, you know, like, I'm pretty cool with that. If I was making a movie and they were mostly white people because I had been exposed to mostly white people, I don't know that that's racist. That's just my history.
That is. Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that commentary, but I don't see that. Never thought of it. Certainly didn't think it the first time I was watching it. I was having a ball. I just thought it was a funny movie with a great cast.
And when did The Cotton Club come out?
That was somewhere around the same time. I couldn't tell you exactly when. Then, you know, the score in the movie is by Herbie Hancock, and I'm assuming he's another one of Eddie Murphy's heroes.
Yeah.
And I mean,
Cotton Club was 84, a few years before.
Okay, so 5 years earlier. And I can, that's, is that a Francis Ford Coppola?
Yes,
it is. Yep.
I've never seen that. So that may be one for me to put on my queue.
There you go.
But just to go to Herbie Hancock, you know, I mean, he was a legend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a jazz musician, worked with Miles Davis, and I thought the score in this was very good, too. I thought it was very evocative of the period piece that they had going, which, considering the fact that, you know, he was older at the time, I guess, Herbie Hancock, but he wasn't, you know, around in the era when this movie was supposed to take place. But I thought he did a good job of giving the feeling.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it never, as weird as it's going to sound, it never stood out. And I mean that as, like, in an appropriate sound. Like if you had a John Williams score sweep at a dramatic moment, that would stand out like a sore thumb. This fit very well. It's like you had your it switches back and forth when you kind of have your easygoing, your comedic, and you're just kind of building up the stuff. You kind of have that like 30s jazz type underground club scene, but then when there's dramatic moments, there's a orchestral piece to it. I thought it was balanced very well.
I've often said that I think that if a score is done right, it's going to enhance your movie-going experience. But if you're not listening for it carefully, you may not even realize that.
There you go.
That.
Yeah.
I use as the example for that one of my favorite films of all time, Raiders of the Lost Ark, which has one of the best scores I can imagine and one of the most memorable scores I can imagine. But the first time I saw the movie, I can't say I noticed it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And see, the opposite on Robin Hood, Prince of Tides, Prince of Thieves. I can't remember. Prince of Thieves.
The
that's
Kevin
all
Costner
I remember.
Vehicle?
Yes.
The Kevin,
that's
Kevin
all
Costner.
I remember is the soundtrack.
Well, I can tell you, I know from talking to him in the past that Kevin Costner is one of Matt's big, big favorites.
Oh, yeah. I see everything.
And yet we're still married.
Yes.
I actually am a fan of his, despite Matt trying to talk me out of it.
Yeah, not a fan.
The fact that they said this film was sexist is real interesting to me, too, because granted, the women in the film were in jobs and roles that would have fit the era. I get that, you know, especially with where they're working. But when this whole sting operation's going down, it doesn't work without the women that
exactly.
were involved. They were absolutely, like, Della Reese was critical.
Yeah.
We had Sunshine, who was, I mean, a pivotal player in the whole thing. I mean, they were very smart, devious characters that were driving the engine on all of this. So even Jasmine Guy's character had multiple layers to her and what
yes,
was going
did,
on. So I'm like, really? What film were you watching?
I think because I read that critic's comment about it, and I'm like, well, yes, he punches her in the face, or in the gut.
Oh, but.
But she beats the living crap out of him.
Oh, yeah.
But, and I guess I can only see that he maybe in the comments about her little gun under the like, oh, so cute.
Yeah, but that,
but,
yeah.
but I don't. I feel like that was hypersensitive.
But there's, but how many women are there in this? There's Della Reese, there's Sunshine, and there's
Jasmine Guy.
So I mean, I don't get that at all. I know Della Reese refers to her girls, but we never see them, and it's not like they're being
girlfriend.
Exploited.
Richard Pryor's girlfriend.
I don't
the one,
remember
the,
her.
I
just watched this movie.
She, like, yeah, because they have sex in the first
okay,
minute.
But still, all right, but that's... Yeah.
But she was
I don't
she came off as a strong character, too. I mean, it wasn't anything that was like...
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the key, honestly, is if these women were shown as sex toys and weak and submissive, yes, then it's a very sexist movie. But they were shown as having very, very tough personalities.
Yeah.
They didn't bow to anybody. And you know, the fact that in the 1920s and 30s, you know, women were in these type of roles is historically realistic. You know, but they're shown as strong characters, and that's, to me, that's what keeps it from being sexist.
Right.
And
yeah.
They're gangsters. they're not just like, yeah, I get it, candy shop, yeah, but they are gangsters. The only other people they are going to associate with are going to be other criminals. So hookers and grifters and that kind of stuff. That's that environment.
And not for nothing, but as we said earlier, the scene with Eddie Murphy and Della Reese fighting is hilarious.
It's
you know, because it's so unexpected. You don't, you know, you can't picture that in your mind until you actually see it. It's like what was the movie with Adam Sandler fighting Bob Barker?
Oh, you know, Happy Gilmore.
Happy Gilmore. You know, because it's just not what you expect. You know, Bob Barker's an old man at that point, and then you know he's punching the crap out of Adam Sandler. Della Reese is, you know, she's an older woman at this point, and she's just punching out Eddie Murphy, and until he shoots her little toe, it's you know, it's just funny.
That is,
which is the only reason he won.
Yeah, that's the most quoted scene in this house from that movie, and it's two quotes. It's anyone stubs their toe, Chris Duggo, you shot me in my pinky toe.
Yeah,
and then if we just see a garbage can randomly somewhere for whatever reason, we'll go, oh, you want to hit people with garbage cans.
or randomly, I will just start going, quick!
Oh, that's it sometimes, yeah. I'll say this. I was alluding to this in the beginning. I have fond memories of this movie because I loved it when it first came out, and I'll watch it when it's on. This is probably the first time I've watched it beginning to end, like, actively. And it became very clear why I'll only watch parts of it. It has the same, I don't know if the word's problem, but it has the same thing to me that Stripes has, where everything I remember about this movie is in the first half of the movie. And the second half of the movie, I don't ever remember any of it and don't enjoy it near as much as the first half. And it's, I actually pulled it up here on my computer to see where that point is. And it's when it's right after Arsenio Hall's scene. That's when I don't remember anything about this movie. And that is almost exactly at the halfway point, just like Stripes.
Asshole.
Well, Stripes is, you know, it's effectively two movies. You have the
Boot
camp and then them being deployed.
Yes.
You know, on a more serious movie, it's the same thing as Full Metal Jacket. If you've ever seen that, where the first half of it is boot camp and the second half is when they're actually in Vietnam.
Yep.
Excuse me.
Spies Like Us.
Oh, yeah, that one too. This movie, if anything, if I have a criticism... And I mean, I do have some criticism, but if my main criticism on it is that it feels a little uneven. The story narrative doesn't flow as smoothly as it could. You're more invested in the characters and the character moments than you are in the story itself. So that's the place where I could say this movie fails a little bit for me. But other than that, I found it very entertaining.
Yeah. I'd say the only real, apart from, like I said, everything I remember most fondly, I should say, is the first half, but I still enjoy the movie, except the ending. I forget how abrupt. It's after Bugsy Calhoun, after him and his guys get blown up, there's not too much wrap up after that. It just kind of ends.
Now they're just looking.
Yeah.
Give the cops their money.
Yeah.
And watch a smoking steamboat go across in Brooklyn.
But I don't know what I expect there more to be either.
Well, I can tell you. I think I could tell you because I think it's an awful lot to ask of the movie. So don't get me wrong to just make it sound like, oh, this is easy. But I think, you know, Sean earlier compared this to The Sting. I think you wanted an ending where they totally made you say, oh, that's what they did.
Yeah.
and to totally shock you. And, you know, like they did in The Sting, where the end of it, you know, you said, oh, that, you know, I saw this coming all along and I didn't realize what was happening.
Yeah.
That's what you wanted here. And they didn't give it to you quite as well as they should have.
I think,
so if they had been able to pull that off, I think this movie would have been a lot more successful.
Yeah. 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 Yep. That would have been, that would have certainly changed it a little bit.
We didn't talk too much about Michael Lerner as Bugsy. And I want to shout him out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You need to hate him.
Yep.
And they did a really good job throughout the film, and it's his acting, of getting to points where you really wanted to hate him. I mean, it worked really well. Mm-hmm. You can do these films without having that pivotal villain, you know, because you just like the main characters so much. But when you really dislike the villain, and Danny Aiello is a big part of that as well.
Yeah.
Danny Aiello was very, very good in this, actually.
Michael Lerner's performance all through this movie, and, well, knowing the characters and everyone's performance. What I'm trying to say is, when him and Della Reese have their scene together, that's probably one of the, like, most, enjoyable scenes without it being comedy, because the way he's treating her, you know, is complete smokescreen. He's just trying to get something out of her. He's not that nice of a guy. Yeah. But you also know why she's there, and she's also pulling one over on him.
Yep.
It's just one of the, it's not comedy, but that scene's just very enjoyable because of how well where we are in the story and how well those two have performed up to this point.
And Della Reese did a great job of Vera, you know, did a great job of in that moment.
Yeah.
You knew what we knew as the viewer what she was doing, but sold me on the fact that, like, I didn't see it going where it did.
That
they were going to blow up Calhoun. I thought that was great. I do have a question. So, Phil Cantone, Danny Aiello's character, do we think they really called the police?
Danny Aiello is an interesting actor because he's mostly in serious roles, but he feels like he's made for comedy.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem quite as threatening as what he's always playing. I guess the first thing I ever saw him in was Fort Apache, the Bronx.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I still think of him in Moonstruck. And he is hilarious in that because he is not. It's one of the things of comedy when somebody is really just genuinely living and they're not playing it for laughs. they're playing it from a genuine place, that makes it even more hilarious. And the fact, like, my mama's going to die.
This is only 2 years later. I didn't realize, and I looked it up now. He plays the same kind of comedy, like his performance in Hudson Hawk, which that's another movie I think is grossly underrated, and he's really fun in that too. Same type of fun.
Yeah, and that's another movie that got blasted by the critics. I almost feel like that was the advent of the internet mentality.
Yeah.
You know, because the internet makes me crazy because everything has to be the absolute best or the absolute worst. There is no such thing as in between. And when Hudson Hawk came out, the world, you know, because the internet really wasn't a thing back then, but the world decided Hudson Hawk is a bad movie.
Yeah.
And people didn't give it a chance because of that. You know, they just assumed, oh, this is horrible. And I think, you know what, it may be worth visiting that one on the show and going through it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think we might have some thoughts about that one that we'll redeem it a little bit. That's
I kind of feel the same about Ishtar.
I've never seen
it. You know what? That came to mind also. It came to mind, but I can honestly say I've never actually watched Ishtar.
Yeah.
No. It was so off-putting that it was like, no, I don't want to see it. It's the joke.
Yeah. Well, this movie seems to fit in that same category where the world decided this wasn't good. Because the world decided it wasn't good, and because I only had a very, very bad VHS copy of it, it took me 36 years to sit down and watch it. And now when I watched it, I thought, why was this so, you know, why was this panned so badly? I don't
exactly
understand.
Yeah.
So, unless you have something else to add, I guess we could rate this. So,
no, like I think I'm good. I will say the one laugh that I think always confuses my wife is when Red Fox puts on those glasses and turns to the camera. I still laugh like harder than I should, but it's the memory of the first time I saw it with a bunch of people at work and we all laughed. So it's like I'm laughing at the memory harder than I'm laughing at the imagery because it is weird how like genuine of a laugh that still gives me just because of the memory. Because I know the joke's coming. I've seen that scene 1,000 times, but it's still, when it happens, I still laugh out of that memory.
Well, that's to me when you know that there's more to it than just the written joke. It's the performance that's entering into it and the visual and the combination of script and film. So, you know, when you can still laugh after you've seen it 100 times, you know there's something there.
Right.
It's got something to it. And this movie has some moments like that, so I definitely, that takes Jaws 4 off the table. I think Jaws is also off the table. So I think it's a matter of going between Jaws 3 and Jaws 2. You know, where do I rank this movie? I would say overall, there were some uneven things. I don't see myself watching this on a regular basis, but I enjoyed the time I did watch it. So I think I'm going to say it's a high Jaws 3 for me.
This one I struggled with because immediately after watching it, I told my wife hasn't seen it yet. And I told her, I said, you need to see this. I said that it was that fun for me. I wish she and I had had the opportunity before this because it would actually help me in where I'm at with my ratings. I think I'm going to give it a low Jaws too. And the reason for that is I really want to hang out with this again. I don't know why I haven't seen this since 89. I don't have a good reason for it. I don't know if at the time I missed it on, you mentioned HBO before, and I had HBO back then. I don't know why I didn't watch this again. I don't have any recollections for it. I remember seeing it in the theater. I remember liking it. But it was a good movie. I feel like the reviews of it are, I don't get them. I don't know what movie they watched. I agree with you, Paul. It's not, you know, it doesn't fall into the Jaws 1 category, but, it's definitely something where I do want to watch this again. I don't see myself watching it as frequently, but I think some of that is I want a little bit of distance because I think half the fun is when you don't remember the sting at the end and how it goes. It's kind of fun to kind of see how that all plays out and then be a little in the dark as this film goes. But I enjoyed it.
I'd say it's probably a mid Jaws 2 for me. It's if I am going to put it on, like actively put it on, I'm going to finish it. I'm not going to, even though the second half is not, I don't think as strong as the first half. I'm going to finish the movie. Now my attention's going to wane probably here and there while watching it, but I'm not going to turn it off. Whereas, you know, something of Jaws 3 or even, well, not even 4, but 3, I would probably walk out of the room at certain points, come back. This one, I'll stay in front of the TV. It's not going to get my full attention like Jaws would, but it's going to get enough of it that I think a mid-Jaws 2 is where I'm going to rate it.
See, just to clarify a little bit, though, where we came on two different ratings, but the way you described it is the same way I'd describe it as well.
Okay, gotcha. I see. Okay.
What do you say, Christy? Is it a Jaws?
Can I give it a Jaws 1.5?
You can give it a whatever Jaws you ride. Like.
Ooh, the Jaws ride. Well, can I give it a Jaws ride?
The shark is broken.
Old and stupid. I love this movie. I unabashedly love this movie. I will stop what I'm doing. I do. You know how you have that one little stuffed animal that makes you comforted, that you know you have it if you ever need it? That is what the Harlem Nights DVD is for me. It is my little, I don't know why I love it so much. It is highly flawed. And there is one weird wipe cut that he does that I'm like, oh, that why? I have a fondness for it that, no matter how many times I see it, I love it even more. So I'm giving it a Jaws.
That's fine. That's the whole reason to have different people on here, to get different perspectives on shows and different perspectives on movies, and have an intelligent discussion about it instead of just saying, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm glad you got me to watch this.
Good.
Even though if you had asked me 6 months ago, I would have told you I've seen it. I'm glad you got me to watch it. I'm glad we had a chance to talk again. And we're going to, I don't know what we're going to hit next, whether it's Hudson Hawk or City Heat or one of these movies, but I'm going to get you guys to come back and we're going to do those movies sometime soon, I hope.
I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
There was one story related to this I just remembered. I used to watch the Arsenio Hall show a lot because it was on when I get back from work at the theater, and it was Oscar season and he was going through the Oscar nominations, and Arsenio Hall said there was one glaring error that has everybody up in arms, and was going on like this whole buildup of a scene that someone should have been nominated for. And he said, roll a clip. And it was his clip from this movie, screaming and crying quick. And that was probably one of the funniest bits that he did that year on that show.
Yeah, I remember that show was big back then. Yeah. So thank you guys for coming on. And
thank you
everybody for listening. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Benny, why'd you put this orange juice in the refrigerator with just a swallow left in the container?
Bill, why'd you leave me the hell alone?
But that don't make no sense. You should have just finished it. Don't put it back in the refrigerator with just a swallow in the container.
Eddie Murphy joins Richard Pryor and Red Fox playing gangsters in Harlem in the 1930s in Harlem Nights. That's one of four new movies we'll be reviewing this week on Siskel and Ebert. I'm Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times. Our first movie is Harlem Nights, and this one is a real disappointment coming from Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor, a recycled collection of 1930s gangster cliches that's like stuff we've seen 100 times before. The movie stars Pryor as the owner of a successful Harlem nightclub in the 30s, and Murphy as his adopted son. The club is so successful that a rival mobster named Bugsy Calhoun sends his sexy girlfriend by to check it out.
What would a woman that fine want in a big, fat, nasty, greasy, fat, stank, bloated, cheesy, back 12 sandwich-eating bastard? What does she want with it?
Oh, she likes fat guys.
Bugsy the gangster wants a piece of the action, and Murphy wants to fight back, but Pryor has a cooler head.
You know, when you die, when you're 89, you got your children and your grandchildren around the bed, that's cool. It ain't cool to die at 27. I'm not going to let you do that to yourself. I'm not going to let you do it to me. Because they kill you, they're going to have to kill me. Because I'm going to kill them.
Taking care of business includes riding herd on the resident madam, played by Della Reese.
So, baby, how are they doing now? We made about $200. How'd they only make $200? I don't never say nothing to you when the crap table and the bar come up short.
Because the bar and the crap table never come up short, just the girls.
Are you saying I'm stealing?
You in charge of the girls, right?
I am in charge of the girls.
Are you in charge of the girls?
I am in charge of the girls.
Either you or them got a problem with their arithmetic.
Red Fox has a supporting role in the movie as a nearsighted croupier.
Where's the hash?
In the middle of the cabinet on the third shelf.
That's not hash, it's tuna fish.
Well, make some tuna then.
You got to do something about them eyes, Benny. You got my mouth all ready for hash and eggs, and you ain't got no hash.
Almost everything in this movie is borrowed from other places, from old gangster movies, from the Cotton Club, from standard Damon Runyon stories. The only thing that's a little original is that nobody in this movie talks as if it's really 1938. The dialogue is distractingly filled with 4- and 12-letter words that sound at home in the nightclub acts of Pryor and Murphy, but in this movie, they only indicate that they don't really want to make a period picture. They just want to dress up in old clothes, ride around in old cars, and do their thing. I know that Eddie Murphy is the number one box office star in America right now, but sooner or later, his reputation is not going to be enough to carry turkeys like this. He's a genuinely talented actor, but unless he's willing to take a few chances, he runs the risk of sabotaging his career before he gets the chance to do the really good stuff that he's capable of.
Well, I was appalled, too, at the movie, and, you know, this is his first job writing and directing a picture, and he really doesn't show anything in the direction of this film that is special. I don't know why he did it other than an ego thing. Now, as far as the script is concerned, it's to say that it took things from the Cotton Club, the Francis Coppola picture, is insulting that film. There's nothing there except the costumes. It has no music. Isn't that interesting?
You have a band in the background and it just plays background music.
There is not one musical number. They didn't want to spend the money. They couldn't find anyone paid enough to write the songs. You would think that would be entertaining. No. Instead, there's a lot of foul language and there is a lot of racism. Black against white and vice versa. So much so you wonder, you know, what are they doing with that stuff here? It's just thrown in, is that thrown in for entertainment value? The whole picture is dead in terms of the way scenes take place. Mm-hmm. They go on and then you're waiting for something to happen.
Every once in a while you get a scene that is obviously there only because it's the sign of amateurish writing, is that he puts a scene in just to explain something that couldn't be explained any other way. So everybody gets together and talks about something so that you will know some plot point that isn't interesting anyway. I think the key thing that Murphy has to ask himself about this script that he wrote is, if somebody else wrote it and submitted it to him, would he have wanted to film it? Yeah. And the answer would be, no, it would go right into the circular file because it's a totally unoriginal, uninventive, uncreative, and unfunny collection of recycled cliches.
I just want to reemphasize how dreary the picture is to watch. There's so much hate on the screen. Hate white, hate black. I just caught me totally by surprise.
And hate women, too. Because unless I miss somebody, there's not a single woman in this movie who is not a prostitute.
Or a madam.
And that isn't even looked at in a negative way. That's just doing business. And at one point, Eddie Murphy actually shoots through the head a girl who has just made love to him and who is still in bed with him just before she was going to try to kill him. This is really negative, bad vibration kind of stuff.
No question.
How anybody thought it belonged in a comedy, that it was funny, shows really twisted values.
Yeah, I feel sorry for young people who go to see it because Eddie Murphy is their hero.